It is an easy thing for a prince to call the spears, but in the end, the children pay the price.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we decided it was time to rebrand and relaunch just in time for the game to do the same with its second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. Be sure to check www.whitebookpodcast.com for more content, generally in written form. Huge thanks go out to George R.R. Martin for creating this world, FFG for a great game, all of our contributors, and you, the listeners. Contact us on this site, facebook.com, as well as Twitter, or email contact@whitebookpodcast.com. This Creative Commons music is Townfish by Spinners.
Welcome to episode 246 of The White Book, where you, my dear listeners, pay the price. Okay, that's really just me joking about our audio issues lately, but I feel like last week was better. Feedback seemed to indicate as such, so we're going to keep trucking and hope that this week is even better than the last. So joining us this week is Team Wright. Actually, to my left, unfortunately, in person, however, is Greg.
Hello.
We're also joined by Luke.
How's it going, everybody?
Not a Skywalker, for everyone that was hopeful. And Patrick.
That's me. Still here.
Whew, we haven't run him off yet. So far, so good.
Not yet. Soon, maybe. We'll see.
Well, this week, we are also joined by a guest. We have Cameron.
Yeah, we have like a
Like Hello. A guest? I think he officially is a guest. It's his first appearance on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we'll get into the meat and potatoes of why you're on the show in a little bit. So, but why don't you give us you know, the quick nickel version of your history in Game of Thrones?
So I've been playing Thrones for about 2 years. I play up here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I'm fortunate enough to play at the Fantasy Flight Gamer every week. So that's pretty sweet. And yeah, I play with a lot of good players up here and really enjoy the game and have been doing pretty well lately with Stark. So yeah, I've been having a good time with it.
Awesome. Glad to hear it. That was the short story. That was actually even shorter than I expected. Way to be.
Whoa. You are definitely the Stark guy. Like, even people that I know who don't know you are like, whenever a new Stark character's out, they're like, man, I wonder what Cameron's going to think of this.
I'm just going to leave it over the mute button.
Well, now you guys can know because my buddy and I have been making a video series reviewing all the new cards, so that's been pretty cool.
Yeah, the Wolf's Wood is excellent. Also, I hate you for being good at Stark in second edition because I really wanted to be good at Stark in second edition. And I'm terrible with them. So there you go.
Where there's a will, there's a way.
I'm a will. But seriously, maybe Cameron could like sell some lessons or something. I think that'd be pretty solid. Good moneymaker.
Oh, no, I hit him up on Facebook. I hit him up on Facebook last week and was just like, hey, so like, what am I doing wrong?
And was his answer everything?
It wasn't quite everything, but it was just like, well, this is how I do it. And I was like, oh, okay.
Luke, it's hard to win when you scoop on turn two every game.
Luke the scoop.
Oh, man. I'm seeing a t-shirt in your future, Luke.
Yeah, you should make it. We played like a bunch of games before the Indiana Regional, and he was scooping constantly. So I gave him the nickname Luke the Scoop.
Also, I want to throw out a quick notice here for the Atlanta Regional, courtesy of Scantrell. Of course, it's actually in Marietta, Georgia, it looks like, on Saturday, May 7th. He said he's TOing the event there, and it looks like they have gotten some sweet extra prizes, some really awesome-looking gold tokens, faction specific power tokens, some three alternate art cards. Looks like they are really doing it upright with some extra stuff here for this event. So look it up on CardGameDB, get all the deets, and go check it out.
Okay, guys, so I think we're going to get rolling with the topic here. And this one is a multi-part, so to speak, though the other parts are coming much, much later. This is preparation for episode 250. It's a little something special we've been working on. It was Greg's brainchild. And all of Team Wright has participated in this at some point or another. Cameron, my apologies for dragging you in to this discussion, but as you have questions or thoughts, feel free to pipe in. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Greg to explain a little bit about what the heck is actually up.
Well, what we're doing here, and this is a little bit more of a discussion, is we are going to share some rules we have created for a new limited format for Thrones with our listeners. And if you're listening to this episode, you should be able to go to the White Book podcast and download those rules and read them as you're listening or afterwards or at a future time. But basically what this started with is a few months ago, I was thinking about 2.0 and basically I was a little sad at the fact that we didn't have a booster draft or some other form of limited format that we could play. And if you played any other card games, including Thrones or Magic the Gathering or other games, there's a good chance you have either seen or played one type of limited format or another. There's booster draft. There is sealed events. There are different types of large scale or large pool draft events, which is what we're going to get into here with Thrones. I've been playing in some form of limited format or another with Thrones essentially since the beginning. I don't know. At least let me throw it back to my co-host a little bit. Each of you, have you played in some form of a limited format before, whether it be Thrones or another game?
Yeah, I mean, I did the 1.0 draft at Worlds this year, and that was a lot of fun. I got rocked a lot because my first draft was pretty bad. I didn't know what I was doing, but it was still fun. And I also do some casual Magic drafts with a friend of mine sometimes, and those are fun too. So yeah.
Yeah, I also participated in the World's draft for 1.0. It was a lot of fun. Managed to get into the top eight and got knocked out by Sam. So that was fitting, but made it pretty fun. Greyjoy Stark deck, and he cleaned my clock with Bleeds. So yeah,
I'll never forget. Cameron, we were both playing Greyjoy and got beaten by Sam.
Yeah, how about that?
Hashtag twins.
Resets are money in draft.
I played draft in the CCG as both sealed deck and booster draft, and those were a ton of fun. I won two tournaments that way. All the way back, way, way, way back.
Yeah, okay. I'm really hoping that FFG supports draft, makes an official system for 2.0 soon. But it sounds like you guys have a system kind of in place for now.
Oh, yeah. I'm dying for more draft. It cannot come to us soon enough. I think this will do in a pinch.
Well, you know, each of you that played draft in 1.0, the interesting thing about that is that when Fantasy Flight turned Game of Thrones into an LCG from a CCG, it made drafting a challenge, and it took them many years and a large outcry from the community to finally formalize their own form of booster draft, which they had with the draft packs. And if you remember, quite often you were playing with those draft packs, sometimes even drafting cards that hadn't been released yet or cards that were only... cards that were only legal for the draft format. Obviously, we are not at a place in 2.0 where Fantasy Flight has launched any sort of draft format. We don't know if they're going to. I haven't heard any word about that. So as I was sitting there thinking about, man, I miss a draft format, I was also playing some fantasy sport or another, most likely fantasy football, and was thinking, man, can't I just combine these two things that I love a lot? And it dawned on me, I can. And so I started thinking about how fantasy sports work in that you have a pool of players, and then when you draft a player, he gets put on your team, and nobody else can draft that player. And this is for your standard rotisserie. And then someone else will draft, and then you go through this serpentine draft where the person who went last in the first round goes first in the second round, and so on and so forth. And you draft until everyone fills up their roster. I thought, man, we could just do that with Throne. So when it dawned on me how simple this would be, particularly considering the core set and the nature of how we release chapter packs, it dawned on me that this will work. Okay. Then it was, how do we make this work in a time efficient manner? So we set out to make some rules. We had some mock drafts, and you know, that's what we are now releasing to our listeners, is here is a limited format you guys can play. Until and even after FFG releases their own limited formats. And hopefully it's something that'll catch on, you know, in meta groups, you know, all around the world, as an alternate version to play the game we love without necessarily having to always play constructed deck tournaments. So let's get into the rules a little bit. I've already mentioned a little bit about what happens during a fantasy draft, and this is very similar. You're going to have a pool of players, probably somewhere between 4 and 8. We recommend that you have 8, but we understand it's just not always that simple. You can't always have exactly 8 people. Within the rules document, you're going to see that you can change the card pool based on the size of players. And so for 4 players, you'd start with a core set. For 5, you'd probably still use a core set. Once you get to 6, you're in a core set and a chapter pack. When I say a core set, I should clarify it. We're at a play set of a core set. Okay. And then when you get to 7 and 8, you're looking at a core set and 2 or 3 chapter packs, depending on how you want to do this. And players are going to then derive a list, basically a draft order. And then what they're going to do is they're going to draft play sets of cards from the draft pool into their own collection, so to speak. So for those of you that have played booster draft, when you get a booster pack, you look at that pack, you choose a card from that pack, and then it gets added to your personal pool of cards that you can build your deck from. Likewise, in this rotisserie format that we are introducing, you will choose a play set of a card that goes in your draw deck, or you will choose one plot, and you will add it to your personal card pool, and then it's the next person's turn to pick in the draft order. And you will continue doing this until you guys have either exhausted the card pool or hit a reasonable amount of cards in your deck that you really don't need to draft anymore. Normally, this is somewhere around probably 35 to 40 rounds. It can even be potentially less, but that's the general area. So we did 4 mock drafts. We did one with Luke and Patrick online.
And me.
And Will. And so you can do it. You can draft online. It's probably the slowest way to go unless you're in a, you know, like a chat server like Discord or Skype or something like that. We did it very slow. We did it over email. Maybe Will and Luke and Patrick, you can share at least a brief snippet about your experience of actually drafting over email.
I mean, I thought it was awesome. It gave me something to look forward to during the workday. so that was a big highlight. But I mean, it gave me a lot of time to plan picks and like contingency plans, like if somebody went a certain direction. Am I remembering right? Chris went on one side of me, and Patrick, I think you went on the other side of me in the draft order.
I think Chris was on both sides of you.
Yeah. You're right. I was at the end. Yeah. You were on the other side of Chris.
I was. Yeah.
That's what it was. I knew I needed to still consider your picks for some reason. I really dug it, Patrick.
It was a lot of fun. I was definitely excited every day to check my email and like figure out what everybody had drafted. I do wish it had gone a little bit faster, and like we would have been like, I wish we could have found a time that we could have all sat down and at least gotten a good chunk of it done, because I think it took like a couple of weeks when all was said and done, like at least a week and a half.
I think it was like two to three weeks.
Yeah. So, but it was a ton of fun. It was awesome. I loved trying to like figure out what everybody was going to do. And it was very tense at times, because like I would take a card and just like be waiting, like refreshing my email, being like, oh no, is Chris going to take the card, or is Will going to take the card before it gets back to me? Like another card that I want. It was a lot of fun.
Speaking of taking cards, I'm a little curious here, Luke. How did that business go for you? What'd you think of that draft, Mr. What'd you wind up drafting in the end again?
Okay, so I was the first player. So I was drafting first every round. Well, I guess first in the first round and last of the second round, and then first again in the third round because it's serpentine. So I would always have two picks in a row. And like I'm a Lannister player, so I drafted Tywin first because why wouldn't you? But Alex and Greg were immediately after me and immediately took Tyrion, and then like snaked back around to me, and I got, you know, I think I got put to the sword so nobody else could take it. And burn men, because ambush is really good, especially in that kind of format, to be able to have that kind of claim soak when there's going to be some small boards, that kind of thing. But then, you know, I hadn't banked on the fact, I was like, holy shit, there's a lot of really good non-loyal Lannister characters. And so like, then people took Jaime and treachery and all these other things. And I was like, oh my God, I got to change my draft strategy. So I decided nobody's taken a single Stark card. So I went heavy Banner of the Wolf, and then
attaboy.
And then people and went,
that was
holy
late too. Like that was,
it was like round four, like halfway, when I took Arya and Bran back to back. And then people were like, oh shit, he's doing this. So they started taking all my loyal Lannister cards. And so it got to the point where I drafted just a Stark fealty deck. And I remember Greg sent out a questionnaire at the end, like, you know, what do you think was the best deck? And like, I think Alex and Greg had the best deck by far. It was a Night's Watch Banner of Lion, and it was disgusting because they had literally every piece they needed.
Yeah,
besides
Alex, real good.
Yeah, I think they had everything except Tears of Lys, right? I mean, it was gross.
That sounds
and,
about.
And then, but the thing is like back then I was like, so I was reeling from the fact that I just got hate drafted for literally like the entirety of the whole thing. And then I look back at it and I said, I have every Stark card except for like two.
Did you still enjoy?
And I have put to the sword. And like, I actually ended up having a really good deck, even though I said that I had a terrible deck, because I ended up drafting both summons so nobody else could take that.
I forgot about that.
I think that's why everybody hate drafted.
No, everybody hate drafted me because I took Tywin first pick. That's why they hated me.
Yeah.
Well, that too.
Don't make yourself a target. So would you say, though, even though you became a target, like, you still had fun with draft as a target?
Oh, yeah, it was a blast. I had so much fun.
You know, for our listeners, as you can see, these guys just did one mock draft. They actually didn't even play games, and they loved the draft itself. And for anyone who's done fantasy sports, most of those people are going to agree that 50% of the fun of a fantasy league is that initial draft. And so there are multiple ways you can do this. You can either do it as we conducted with this particular draft via email. You can do it in person. In person might be the quickest way to do it. What you will do is you'll take three core sets so you can get a play set of every draw card in the core set. And then assuming you have eight people, you'll choose three chapter packs. And as a group, you'll have to decide on that. I would say just for variety's sake, you're probably going to want to choose the latest three chapter packs so that like 6 months later, if you do another rotisserie draft, you'll be playing with three different chapter packs. Okay, and then you take a play set of each one of those cards. And then you take every plot that exists in those chapter packs and the core set. And you have two copies of each of those plots unless the plot has a limit one per plot deck. And in that case, there's only one available. So when you draft, you're either drafting a plot or a play set of a card. So essentially, like as these guys were saying when they were reminiscing on this mock draft, when someone came and drafted Tywin, nobody else could draft Tywin. It was done. But that person who drafted him has the full play set of Tywin to use. Okay. The only cards where potentially someone can have the same cards in their deck are the fact that there are two copies of some plots, and then there is a starter deck. Okay, so everybody does get a list of cards to start with. It is three Varys, three Rose Road, three King's Road, and two Wildfire. Okay, so everybody gets that. You do not draft Varys, you do not draft Rose Roads, you do not draft King's Roads, and you do not draft Wildfires, because everyone gets those quantities as a starter deck. Moving on to different draft types, we mentioned one over, you know, email and then doing one in person. There's the possibility maybe in the future we can get a draft app up and going, whether that be a PC app or a phone app. There's an option there. But obviously, I think once we cross that border, we're going to have to get FFG's approval.
Greg, I had a question. So
yeah.
So I remember like the thing that like solidified the fact that I could not play Lannister Banner of the Wolf was the fact that two different players took Western Fiefdoms and the Lannisport Merchant. So like six economy cards gone. Even though I had Tywin, I still didn't have the low curve stuff to be able to jam in there to be able to play my Lannister cards. So, like, what was the decision process in terms of making the economy cards part of the draft pool as opposed to part of the standard player package?
Well, part of that was to add stress and tension to the draft itself, and I did that with a particular baseline in play, and that was the fact that with 2.0 right now, most of my decks, I only run three King's Roads and three Rose Roads. Sometimes I'll mix in one or two at a house specific, reducing locations, and then I do often run the one cost reducing character. But I know it isn't necessary to run like nine limited locations. So the fact that I knew it wasn't necessary to still build a competitive deck was the baseline for me. And then I said, would it be more fun just to assume you get those, or would it be more fun to actually fight over them, to create a metagame within the draft itself to say, are you going to spend your first and early picks on some big bomb character, or are you going to spend your first and early picks on trying to build an econ base for your deck?
You know, I have to say, in the live draft that we did here, I actually spent all of my early picks trying to nab those little one-cost reducers, and I got them for like three or four different houses before people were like, oh, crap, I've got to jump on this. And it's just really amusing, I think, to me, what that does to the pool. Now, whether that's good or not, I don't know, but I thought it was interesting that it kind of forced people to reevaluate their priorities.
If memory serves me correctly, Will, you drafted Melisandre and Scene in Flames first, right?
In the email draft, yes. I did a second draft here. That I tried to go after the reducer.
Yeah. Because you learned from my mistake.
Sort of, yeah. Well, mainly I'd kind of been arguing part of this point with Greg, as far as like, I was kind of worried that if somebody wanted to muck with a draft, that they could potentially make things in like unplayable for somebody else. So I was trying to really screw with it by grabbing resources and stuff. Like
that. Hey,
I don't think I screwed anyone either.
Hey, Patrick, what was your experience drafting plots? Because you draft in the email draft, I remember I started the run on plots with summons, and then I think you were the first player to take another.
I think in both the email draft, not in my in-person draft, but in the email draft, my first priority with plots was definitely economy. I had a pretty expensive deck. I got like Balon and I want to say like Randall and Margaery or something like that. So I had a pretty high curve. Margaery, obviously not, but Balon and Randall, and I think I may have had somebody else expensive. So I was definitely going for econ plots. I think I got Noble Cause and Calling the Banners as my first two plots. But then in my in-person draft, I definitely didn't do that, and it was a mistake. Because I ended up with like no econ plots and just a terrible deck overall. That's kind of a story for later in this segment, probably, but my second deck was awful.
So one of the things I just hear you guys saying is that there is a balance that you have to try and find. And you are competing with your other drafters as to what that balance is, the balance between, you know, powerful in-house cards versus econ. Versus even, you know, one of the things you guys haven't mentioned, but I know one of the other drafts did, is that there was a big fight over neutral cards, okay? Because there is only one play set of Tears of Lys. There's only one play set of Put to the Sword. There's only one play set of Littlefinger. So when someone drafts it, it's gone, okay? And so there is this consistent tug of and pull in terms of what direction you want to build your deck. And the fact that you can hate draft other people, or you can just simply take a really good card that you know would fit in any deck, but you're taking it not only to benefit yourself, but to also prevent anyone else.
Yeah. So I guess I'm curious. I want to ask everybody else on the cast, like, what is your draft strategy? Because, like, I play fantasy football, too. And so, like, depending on the year and depending on, you know, of course, the injuries in preseason and all that stuff, like, I have different draft strategies going into it. Also, depending on my draft slot, you know, if I'm first, then I'm going to draft differently than if I'm in the middle of the pack and that kind of thing. And so I'm curious as to what everybody, having done this now, and Cameron, of course, you know, just having heard this talk about it, like, what might you consider to be a draft strategy round by round for the first, say, like, you know, three or four rounds?
Well, I feel like hate drafting is always going to be a part of kind of the strategy, regardless of what you're doing. But personally, I tend to stick with what I know. So I'll tend to gravitate towards factions that I'm more comfortable playing. And worst case scenario, maybe I see a faction I'm not as comfortable with, but I'm getting great cards out of that faction. So maybe I'll change my strategy. It really just depends on what kind of cards I'm seeing come down the line.
Yeah, I think for me, for this style of draft, the strategy I had in our email draft was to kind of go for my bombs first. I basically tried to figure out which house had the most bomb characters or locations or whatever left when it got to me in the first round. And I think I decided on Greyjoy because I think that Greyjoy is kind of a pretty easy house and they're pretty good for draft. They're pretty good at Power Rush, which is good in a limited format. And in my second draft in person, I tried to do more of a kind of go for a good banner package first. So I tried to get a bunch of good non-loyal Tyrell cards and then kind of scoot into a main faction. And it went terribly because all of like the good main faction cards were gone after like the second or third round. When I had picked like three good Tyrell cards, like all of the main factions that combo well with Tyrell were already taken. So I think definitely going for bombs early, if other people are doing that, is really important.
Yeah, maybe looking out for the loyal cards and seeing what you're, or and picking the ones that you're seeing the most is a good strategy to start off with, like you said.
Man, I'm worried about committing to a house too early. I want to try and take non-loyal stuff if possible. But on the other hand, also, you know, since this whole thing is open knowledge instead of, you know, like a regular booster draft, I kind of really like the idea of trying to leverage kind of wedges into the pool, as I thought of it during our email draft. Now, that worked out for me really well because I had some double picks because I was at the end of the first rotation. But I think you could do it otherwise too. And what I mean by that is trying to look for stuff that has like a strong synergy together, where one card has kind of an open play and the related like synergistic card is kind of more dead without that. So like the Melisandre and Scene in the Flames thing put me heavily into the R'hllor Neil package by nabbing a couple of the best and drastically lowered the value of those R'hllor cards to somebody else, which meant that, you know, my odds of picking them up later in the draft were a little better because they didn't really want to blow their pick on it. Or like, I think you could do something similar, say with the hatchlings. If you grab them, they're not loyal. They're really efficient on their own. So maybe you can grab them. Now your opponents then, of course, want to try and keep Dracarys from you. But if you've nabbed a couple of the hatchlings, their odds of being able to play Dracarys are low. So then they're just hate drafting to take that from you. I don't know. I like trying to like force my opponent into taking a dead pick in my mind.
So a final method of drafting that I hadn't mentioned before, which is a live drafting method. If you don't physically have the cards and you're not planning on playing the games that day, you could actually do a draft board. Such as Fantasy Sports use, where you have a big board up there and people just, when it's their turn to pick, they yell at the name, you write it up on the board, and then everyone can go home and use their list and their own cards to actually build their draft deck. And speaking of ownership, the physical ownership of the cards that are being used, There are several different ways you can go about doing this in terms of whose cards are whose when you do a draft. One of the ways, and this is probably the most expensive way, but some people still may not mind doing this, is that you simply purchase the cards you need. So, like, let's say you had an 8-person draft and you did it with, you know, 3 core sets and then 3 chapter packs. The retail price of that is $165. So divided by 8 people, it's a little over $20 a person. And then you can even say, keep the cards you draft. And there are always people saying, I want more of this or I want more of that. You know, that is the most expensive way. And I'm not saying you have to do it that way, but that is one way to do it. A second way to do it is that one person simply donates all the cards. So if you're doing a live draft where there are physical piles of cards that you're drafting from, one person can donate all those. People supply their own Varus, Kings Road, and Rose Road, and Wildfire. But then once you're done with the draft, you give everything back to that one person because it's their card. And then the third way is that once you've done a draft in whatever format you've used, whether it's online or live, is that each person then goes back to their own personal collection and builds the deck from the list that they've drafted. Okay, then you don't have to worry about giving back any cards and you're still using your own cards. And it also encourages people to, you know, still have these cards in their collection for when playing in this particular format. So it's not like people are trying to get away from, you know, having to purchase cards. They still need to own them in order to do that.
You mind if I cut in here for a second, Greg?
Yeah, go ahead.
So Cameron, I'm curious, since this is the first time that you've actually heard of this, like, what do you, as sort of a, like, representative listener, think of this format until we get sort of alternate limited format? I'm not sure.
I think it's really great. My friend Ryan Ritter and I are constantly trying to do special events for our own meta in Minnesota. We have a couple unique tournaments that we run, and we have unique prizes and stuff like that. So I think any way to encourage people to play this game is great, and especially in different ways, like draft, ways that people haven't tried yet. And like it's been mentioned, like, drafting in and of itself is so fun. And I think it's great to have this as an option until you do something eventually, but, you know, maybe not this year. So, but yeah, everything sounds really fun. And I like the idea of maybe once the draft is over, kind of divvying out the cards according to maybe what people actually need. Because as you guys are aware, the core set maybe could have used some more Pit of the Swords, Tears of Elise, and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm a big fan.
So a couple more things I want to point out. One question people are going to have is, what are deck building rules? And in terms of the standard way we're going to play this, is you still have to follow all deck building rules. You still have to have a 60-card deck. You know, have to follow everything else you would when building a, you know, standard legal deck. I will point out this. You do have access to every agenda that the game has. So every banner, including Fealty and Lords of the Crossing, you can play with any of them. Okay, so when you're drafting your cards, you can keep that in mind. You can draft Dual House, understanding that you're going to be able to play with a banner. You are not drafting agendas. So someone might ask, what happens if you don't draft 60 legal cards? Well, in each of our drafts, that was not a problem. Like, we never had someone who couldn't actually play a legal deck, but if that does happen, you will simply fill up to 60 cards with cards that are turned backwards that do nothing. Okay, so if you drafted a 54-card legal deck, you'd have to fill in with 6 cards, you know, backwards. But I really, unless you choose a massive size of draft pool a massive number of drafters with a really small draft pool, you shouldn't have this problem. Just follow our recommendation. Likewise, if you don't have 7 plots, and keep in mind you start with 2 Wildfires, so you really only need to draft 5 more plots, you will fill up to 7 plots with a blanket 301 plot that's called Court Pool and has no text. So, like, if you only have 6 plots, your 7th one will just be a 301 with no text. A couple other suggestions: you'll want to limit drafting time, particularly in person, to 30 seconds or less. And as I mentioned before, probably limit picks to 35 to 40 rounds of picks. After that, your deck's
gonna... Wait, Greg, wasn't our stipulation when we did the first email draft, wasn't that the plot was that you had to give your opponent a copy of a card in your deck.
Yeah, that was the original one, but I ended up toning that down just to make it less confusing for draft lists. Once, if someone actually wants to run a tournament this way, that particular card didn't really fit a tournament format where you have to have a list to prove that you're playing with the cards that you drafted, so to speak. So, you know, having cards that left someone's deck and ended up in someone else's just didn't really work. It was a cool idea, but just didn't fit what we were trying to do. Now, another question people are going to ask, though, is can they make modifications? And just like as with any game, you can do whatever you want to do. You know, if you want to play Game of Thrones in your living room and make up whatever rules you want to, you are more than welcome to. You know, we've just set forth some standard rules that we see as the normal way that you can play, but there might be some play groups that say want to do away with loyalty so that they can, you know, play, you know, loyal cards in a banner house. They may want to allow for out of faction playing where you can just pay a gold penalty or something like that, you know, or maybe even lower deck size or plot deck size. So those are options, but they're just not part of our standard.
So I have a quick question, Greg. In terms of agendas, so you're saying that we don't need to have, say, the pack that the agenda is in the pool in order to use that agenda. So even if I were using three packs and I wasn't using the pack that Lords of the Crossing came out in, I would still be allowed to use Lords of the Crossing?
Yes. Yes. That is one of the rules of the game right now, that we are allowing people to use any agenda. Now, I think what we will end up finding later on, so maybe a year or two from now, when we get some theme-specific agendas, if you're not playing with the pack that agenda came out with, there's a good chance you may not have the support cards to make it work. Obviously, right now, we just have Lords of the Crossing and Fealty, so they're not necessarily theme-oriented, so that's not an issue. But as of right now, yes, every agenda is available for every player.
What do you plan to do when the winter and summer agendas come out?
They will still be, those two agendas will be available for every player. Now, you know, a follow-up question, since we do have a lot of winter stuff in the Stark boxes, what are we doing with the house-specific boxes? Right now, we're not doing anything. Right now, the house-specific boxes are not part of this. We're going to, you know, once we get more of these boxes, we may look at some alternate draft means that incorporate the boxes. Unfortunately, they create such a heavy lean towards one house when you include a box that becomes a problem for an even distribution of faction cards within the draft pool. So that's just going to be something we tackle later on down the road when there are house boxes available for every faction.
One question that I also had is, like, does this format suit Joust or Melee better?
That's a good question.
That is.
And probably not something that's yet fully determined. I'd like to believe that it's going to work for both.
I tend to think that it actually does favor both pretty well. Because if you're taking a randomly constructed deck into either format, you're still wandering in with a suboptimal deck in some ways, but your deck has certain exploitable strengths. I don't know. It could be fun. If you have an 8-player pool, then Melee is totally viable because you have two tables. If you have anything less than that, then it seems it's suboptimal at that point. But it was just something that I thought of.
Yeah, I'm curious.
All right, well, two things I want to do before we wrap up this segment. One is I do want to give a shout out to several groups that did mock drafts. We had an Iowa team with Jared, Ben, and Dan who did a draft with a core set only, and I really appreciate their feedback. They gave me some important information with that, with a smaller group and a core set only pool. We mentioned we had a draft in my house with several of the Oklahoma people, Matt and Chris, and Josh, then some Tennessee people, Scott and Kristen, Crystal, excuse me, and then some of our locals, Will and Kristen and Sam. And then we had the online version, which you guys have referenced several times, that was mostly the White Book team, you know, Patrick and Luke and Will and Alex and Tommy, and then Chris Kaiser was involved as well. And then Patrick ran one in Wisconsin with Ben Lucas, Michael Evan, Jack, Brian, and Jesse. So I just want to, number one, just give a thank you to all of you that were willing to do this. And then next, we have a contest for our listeners. So those of you that like the idea of this format, that would like to come on the White Book Podcast and take part in a recorded draft, we have an opportunity for you. So what we're going to do on episode 250, and Will mentioned, what episode are we on right now, Will?
246.
246. So four episodes from this one, we will be bringing on eight lucky listeners who have applied and essentially won the contest to come on the podcast, do a draft, and then play some games in a round robin tournament between those eight members. And this is basically the qualifications you have to have to even be eligible. Okay, so if you can't do this, don't apply, right? Number one, you have to have access to Google Spreadsheets online while also having Google Hangouts, which is where we record from. Okay, so if you can't do that, I apologize, but we're not going to be able to have you. Number two, you need to be available on the Wednesday of recording, so essentially 4 weeks from the Wednesday.
It's actually going to be longer than four weeks. I'll announce this here and re-announce it later in the episode. I meant to lead with it, but it'll be in props and slops.
Okay.
I mentioned this in passing a couple episodes previously. I am taking a couple weeks off due to wedding and prep. So this is actually going to be the last episode for a couple weeks
until
after the wedding. So it's going to be more like 6 weeks.
Okay.
Four episodes, 6 weeks.
Well, that's good because that gives our listeners some time to, you know, listen to this episode and then send in, you know, their application. Okay, but you will have to be available on a Wednesday night from about 8 p.m. Central to 10:30 Central. Okay, if Wednesday nights are not a good night for you, please don't apply. You have to have the ability to play a single game with each of the other seven participants. So eight total, you got to play a game against each of the other people.
You're not playing the games on just...
No, you're not. You're going to play those off air. Obviously, if we have people from around the world, these games are going to happen via some online media like Octagon or something like that. If there happen to be two people in the same area that want to play their game sitting around the table, by all means, please do. I would say you need to play at least two games per week so that we can get through these seven games per person in about a month. You also need to have the ability to possibly come back on the show. So if you do really well, or if we want to interview, you know, several people after the draft and tournament, we'll bring them back on. You also cannot have participated in any of our four mocks. I apologize. That's really sad. But if you're one of my mock drafters, you're not eligible for the contest unless you really, really beg. So we'll see how that goes.
We want to spread the love.
Yeah. And then obviously you need to be willing to make your picks quickly, like within 20 to 30 seconds. If you're on air, sitting there for like 5 minutes trying to think of your pick, not only is that bad radio, but it really is going to make for a long draft. So you're going to have to pick quickly. So I know you're asking the question, right? How are we choosing these eight people? Real simple. You need to send an email to the White Book saying that you are interested. Will, what is that email address?
Well, it is contact@whitebookpodcast.com, though I do admit I've been having some trouble with the email lately. So it may actually be more practical to message us on Facebook. So if you email us and don't see a response within a day or two, message us on Facebook.
Okay, so what you'll be doing is sending an email or a Facebook message saying that you are interested. And then what you are going to do is you are going to send in your guess for the top five highest drafted cards in our four mock drafts on average. Okay, when I say highest drafted, I mean closest to the first pick in the draft. You're basically saying these are the five cards I think we're taking on average, you know, as the first five cards in every draft. Now, obviously, the first five cards weren't the same, so I will have tabulated an average. And the eight people who come closest to guessing those five cards, or their five guesses are closest to being the top of the draft, those people will be selected for the draft. One thing you might note is when you are looking through our rules, which again is going to be available on the White book webpage, you will see that I actually have a picture of one of our mock drafts. So you can see the first, six, seven, maybe even up to 20 rounds or so. You could base your guesses strictly off that list. Of course, everybody has access to see that list, so you may also be wrong or guessing the same as everyone else. So just keep that in mind, that if you're making your top five picks based off of top five of one draft, you may be way off, but you also may be way right. So anyways, I kind of look forward to this, and I hope some of our listeners would enjoy this. And again, please contact us and let us know that you would be interested.
Well, now I want to get into the bread and butter of why Cameron's on the show here. We want to take the opportunity to talk some Melee. I'm trying to push Melee a bit harder for the game these days. It has been listed as an official thing for FFG for quite a while. Format, that's the word I was trying to think of. But hasn't really ever quite attained the prestige that I feel it's due, which is kind of a shame, especially because a lot of people are talking about really loving it now with second edition. So, in fact, I think some folks are starting to host some Melee tournaments. And Cameron, I hear you did pretty well at one, right?
Yeah. So we hosted our own Melee tournament up here in Minneapolis. We dubbed it the King in the North tournament. It's something we're going to be doing every few months up here, just to kind of mix things up between store championships, regionals, and stuff like that. But yeah, we had a good turnout for being our first one. We had 26 players. This happened late last month. And let's see, we did three rounds before the cut to the final table, of course, and played for about 6 hours total that day. And yeah, I saw a lot of different kinds of decks, but in particular, a lot of Greyjoy, Lannister. I saw like one Targ and a good amount of Stark, and it was definitely a fun day. People seemed to enjoy it and seemed to be interested in playing again. So I think we'll be doing it again here in maybe a couple months. So
what did you?
I brought Stark Crossing. Crossing seems like a really good agenda for Melee. Just a little extra power and the +2 strength to really push through that challenge that's most important to you. There was quite a bit of Crossing, and actually at the final table, it was three Crossing decks. So there was Martell, Greyjoy, me playing Stark, and then there was a Stark Banner to the Rose deck that made it to the final table. So, yeah.
Did y'all watch that game?
I had not had
it. Me neither.
I watched it.
Pretty interesting.
I watched it. It was a really good Melee match. It just came down to initiative, which there was a choice involved, and turned out that the Greyjoy player made the wrong one. But it had everything you wanted in the first two rounds of a Melee match. It was really cool. Yeah. But Cameron, wasn't it called the Lord Commander Tournament?
Oh, yeah, that's what I thought.
Yep. Sorry, got it mixed up. You're completely right.
you have the playmat. How did you get that confused?
Sorry. Thinking about something else. The King in the North tournament is actually something we're going to be doing in September. The Lord Commander is, yeah, that's the Melee tournament.
Has the King in the North been announced yet?
No, it hasn't, but I'd be happy to announce it now.
It's been announced now.
Yeah, here it is.
Sounds like the scoop.
Yes. So yeah, we're going to be doing kind of our own little Minnesota Worlds, I guess you could say, the King of the North. It's going to be a joust tournament, naturally. And I think we have it slated for September 10th. And we are featuring the art of the artist who did Robb Stark. He's done a lot of other cards as well for Game of Thrones. So we have a lot of alt arts, and we're doing a playmat with that Robb. All sorts of good stuff. We're hoping for a good turnout. So if you are in the area or vicinity, then maybe mark it down on your calendar and stay tuned on the MN Game of Thrones LCG channel on YouTube. We'll be doing like trailers, unveiling some of the swag and whatnot, and more information will come. So there you go.
Will there be more Dragon Fears available?
More Drakkar's Dragon Fear cards? Maybe. I think so. Those are good, like, little Sanser prizes that we do, or Edmure prizes. Yeah, the game was good. It's on that YouTube channel I just mentioned if you want to check it out. Ryan and I did a commentary. It's about an hour long. But yeah, like Luke mentioned, it really did come down to initiative and pretty much deciding who the first player was going to be and whatnot. And I definitely took advantage of some people's mistakes, but hey, that's Melee, right? So...
Well, speaking of things,
you mean like the Martell player that knelt out his entire board and let you get three unopposed challenges with Renown and Crossing?
Oh no!
Hey, I wasn't going to stop him.
That's fair.
Well, it was weird because the Greyjoy player was running initiative plots the entire time, and the seating order just like really screwed the other Stark player at the table who was playing Stark Rose. And his deck was fast and he got stuff out. Him being first player for the first two rounds just really threw off the order of everything.
Definitely. Yeah, if you guys are interested, my Melee deck that I played for that tournament is actually on ThronesDB2. It's called The Pack Survives. If you just do a search for that, it'll come up. You can kind of see just by looking at the deck kind of what my strategy is. But yeah, I feel like Stark is a really solid faction for Melee, you know, with things like Winter's Coming, Catelyn, Rob. They have some really nice Melee cards, I think. I think Greyjoy, though, is pretty much the house to beat, especially now since they have Ahead of the Tide. Just can really seal the initiative pretty easily with that card. But yeah, it was a really great tournament, and I'm glad we did it.
Well, that leads me to two. One is, I can't believe Luke hasn't hounded you enough for us to have your deck list on the white book. And two, I'm noticing a real theme that keeps coming up in discussion.
To be fair, Will, I did post on his deck list on ThronesDB to submit to the white book.
So in other words, yes, you have found it.
I think, I'm not sure if I did it for the Melee deck, but at least my Joust deck, I believe I submitted. So I'll take a look at it.
Well, the other point I was thinking of that keeps coming up here in the discussion is one that I think is really important to hit on in Melee. And that's the importance that is of initiative. I mean, it's already even more important in Joust in second edition than it was in first. But the importance of initiative in Melee is so much multiplied compared to Joust that I think that can throw off some players that aren't used to that pacing and looking for opportunities and stuff, you know, and figuring out their placement in turn order versus like title picks. There's a lot to consider with initiative, you think?
Definitely. I mean, winning initiative alone gives you the right to choose the title first. Of course, maybe the title that you want has been burned, but still you have that option. Let's see, what's the redirect? Which one is that? The Crown Regent?
Yes.
Right. Yeah. So that alone is like, if you're trying to close a game out, and if that's one of the titles and you want initiative, just having that so that no one else can mess with you and redirect maybe the challenge you need to win to close out the game is really nice. And of course the Hand of the King as well, the double power challenge, if that's available, is really killer. But yeah, initiative is very, very important.
I want to talk about in Melee, I want to talk about control options, because the decks just, to me at least, seem like they're not there. And it seems like Rush for now is still king, and I'm curious if you think that this might change in the future.
Not huge.
Do I think Melee will be more viable, or control will be more viable for Melee in the future? Is that what you said?
Yeah, basically. I mean, like, because right now, some variant of Rush is going to be king, like either do more challenges or you know, get more renown, high initiative with high claim. Like, some flavor of Rush is gonna absolutely take home the table in Melee as the game is currently constructed right now. So, you know, I'm wondering if there's ever going to be a way to leverage more control oriented decks, or if we think that it's just going to take a long time, or it may never happen.
I think so. With cards like Even-Handed Justice coming out, where it's you can obviously affect a lot of characters with that card, and it's also kind of a bargaining chip. You know, if control decks have more effects like that, more powerful effects like that, which can really swing a game into your favor and make deals with people really easily, then sure. I mean, I could definitely see control decks taking some wins in Melee. Of course, Rush is always going to be a thing, but yeah, I've, you know, if the player is you know, skilled and knows the control deck really well, then sure, why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, from my limited experience in Melee, I haven't played a ton, but it seems like control is just naturally at a disadvantage in Melee, because when you're playing against multiple different people, if you're playing control, you need to control three people at once rather than just the one in Joust. And like Cameron said, cards like Even-Handed Justice can do that, but I think until we see a lot more cards that hit the whole table like that, control's going to have a really tough time in Melee. And also, control's kind of not fun sometimes to play against. Like, Baroneel, it's really not that fun to play against. And so people are going to get annoyed at you in a Melee game, whereas Rush, while it's not fun when it beats you, is not necessarily a miserable experience while it's beating you.
Interesting.
That's a good point about not making yourself a target of too much hate. But I gotta agree with the control stuff needing to kind of be able to scale out to more players. But Even-Handed Justice is not the only one we've seen like that. I would put Brothel Madam in that same kind of boat. Sure, we'll need more, but it looks like they're dropping a few on us as the game goes on.
It's interesting that you mentioned the idea of Melee being fun. And so this is sort of the hot button question, the buzzword question, you know, like, is Melee a viable competitive format? And let's see, I mean, everybody who played at Worlds last year, but Cameron, you just played in a full-on 2.0 event that has a bigger card pool than just the core, and you had a decent sample size of people there. What do you think about the competitive nature of Melee, and do you think it's meta-dependent, or do you think that it's more card-dependent slash game-mechanic-dependent?
I had a good experience with Melee. Obviously, I'd like to play more games with 2.0 and kind of get more of a feel for it. But as far as it being a competitive versus Joust, I mean, I think it's, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because wasn't Game of Thrones originally designed with the Melee format in mind, and they kind of switched over to the Joust? But at any rate, I think Joust or Melee can be competitive. Of course, there's more negotiations and there's more elements at play. You have to deal with people who are going to be making mistakes, and there's more out of your control in that sense. But I feel like Melee is a whole different kind of skill set that's required. And that certainly can be a competitive skill that you can work on and get better at. So I feel like it should be a competitive event. And I kind of feel like it's a shame that isn't Melee only supported at Worlds. Like, it's not like you can play Melee at regionals or anything like that. I would like to see more Melee all around.
That's one that does really bug me. You know, it used to be that F of G would have Melee at their regionals. That was one I'd won, but I don't think that's the case this year, right?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a disconnect between, like, I mean, definitely for FFG-sponsored events and, like, their store championships and regionals and all that, we've definitely seen that it's only Joust. But I think, kind of, you know, in North America especially, a lot of people kind of look down on Melee, and I think it's a little bit different in Europe from what I've seen. You know, a lot of the Europeans that I met at Worlds were a lot more enthusiastic about Melee and really liked the format. And we had that whole big fiasco between, like, Europeans versus North Americans and their opinions on how people should play Melee and things. And I think that's a really interesting kind of split between the community. But I think that Melee definitely can be a great competitive format. I mean, we've had it at Worlds for years now, and I know that a lot of people really enjoy it and, you know, are very competitive about
regionals
it.
Too.
Yeah. I think a lot of the challenge is honestly just, like, time. I know for me personally, you know, all of my regionals, the closest one to me is, like, 2 hours. And so a lot of these tournaments, it's tough to be able to, like, go and stay for more than one day. So having a separate Melee event means that a lot of players would have to stay overnight. And that's a problem for a lot of people. So they've kind of picked Joust as the format to be. But I would personally be totally cool with, you know, Melee being an additional format, and you can stay and play in both or just play in one or whatever people want to do.
Yeah, it actually kind of bugs me that it's not done that way across the board. You know, FFG used to bill regionals as trying to bring that kind of con experience to a more local setting and whatnot. And they keep saying that Melee is an official format. They do support it at the events that they run at the larger levels, Commonwealths and Worlds and such. And so, you know, it bugs me that they don't require people to run those for regionals, or at least have a program of Joust regionals and Melee regionals, you know?
Patrick, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the fact that the Europeans view it differently. Did you notice that in Le Tournoi de la Main in Paris that they had two people drop from top 32 to focus on Melee?
I didn't see that, but I'm not surprised at all. I know talking...
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, talking to LaPlante at Worlds, and I had the opportunity to play a game of Melee with him in second edition, and he was, you know, he is very intense about Melee, and I would not be at all surprised if you know, players from his group who share his enthusiasm would drop out of Joust to focus on Melee.
You know, I'm kind of curious here. I'm going to tie together a couple concepts floating around in my head. A little bit in this conversation, plus some other stuff. Okay, so we're kind of talking right now, it seems, about what people enjoy and get out of Melee, when they do enjoy it, that is, or if they do, right? And you guys probably saw, you including the listeners at this point, probably saw I wrote a couple articles that were up on FFG's site and should be archived and up on the White Book site here shortly about my proposed Melee personality kind of archetypes. And I'm kind of curious if there's some connection here to what people enjoy and get out of Melee, and whether maybe some folks even are a certain type of Melee personality, even if they don't really feel they are or enjoy it. Meaning, maybe in a nutshell, I should say what those four personalities are. We've got Cersei, who, much like Cersei in the novels, is just looking for the fastest, most efficient route to power, regardless of, you know, the fallout and potential downsides can be kind of brittle. Then you've got the Brienne, who's more on the defensive side and, you know, values their deals, their honor, their word. You've got the Queen of Thorns, who really is playing the social game, doesn't want to look like a threat until they're in striking distance, and enjoys playing other people against each other or trying to alter their decisions. And then you've got the cello player, who just wants to cause chaos, and their enjoyment is completely separate from winning, and it is causing pain and suffering to the other player. And I wonder if maybe some of the folks that don't enjoy Melee actually fall into a couple of those. So I'm thinking maybe there's an aspect. I feel like the Cersei player type lines up somewhat with the Jaime on the Joust side. It's all about that victory. And I wonder if that brittleness kind of comes into play here, where, you know, if they can't win, if someone else stops them and they feel like that's out of their control, you know, they don't enjoy that. Or likewise, I wonder if maybe some of those people fall into maybe the Chella camp, and their measure for enjoyment is just something totally separate, and that's why they don't enjoy the kind of social interaction and means to win the game.
So recently, well, not too recently, maybe a couple months ago, we had a Sword Championship, and kind of after the cut, some people were just kind of messing around playing Melee for funsies. And one of them was my buddy, Austin, who just started playing this year, and this was his first time playing Melee ever. And his takeaway was that he wasn't too thrilled with it, and it was mostly because he felt like it was just kind of a lot of sitting around and waiting for people to make decisions. And not only that, but a lot of what was happening was completely out of his control. Of course, he was also playing Greyjoy too. So, you know, he can't, He's just kind of doing his rush thing or rush or bust, basically. So, but for him, it wasn't too positive of a first experience. And I can definitely see why having that feeling of no control and very little interaction in the grand scheme of things can be very frustrating for new players. So it's an interesting thing to try to introduce someone to the Melee format and try to also make it fun and show them the good side of it, I suppose, without that negative experience.
I'm curious how many people play board games that also enjoy Melee, because I know that, for instance, I love Diplomacy. Like, Diplomacy, in my opinion, is the best board game that's ever been made, and it's all skill-based, but you still can't control what other people are going to do, and you can't control what orders they write down, and I still find it really, really fun. And so, therefore, I generally tend to like Melee because a lot of those same mechanics appear. I don't know. I think that Melee is sort of one of those things that if you don't enjoy planning with other people, then you're not going to enjoy it. Because, like, Melee, like, is hard to play solitaire with. Like, it's hard to play solo. It's hard to, like, not take into account all three other board states. It's really, really difficult. And if you're used to just only taking into account the thing that's across the table from you, and you don't play Melee very often, then that's going to be tough. So I think it really has to do with practice. And because I would assume that most people in this community also play board games that involve you taking stock of other people's positions and those kinds of decisions and that kind of, I don't know. I think it really just has to do with playing the actual game. I could be wrong, and I know that sounded like really rambly, but I think I'm a big proponent of Melee, and I'm trying to sort of articulate my way through people's reservations, and I'm not doing a very good job of doing that.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. I mean, for me, a lot of the enjoyment that I get from Melee is the same kind of enjoyment that I get from playing board games. I also really enjoy Diplomacy and games like that where you're kind of having to make alliances with people and breaking them and trying to backstab people at just the right moment, and all of that is a lot of fun. And I think that definitely shines through in Melee. And yeah, like you said, trying to play Melee solo is next to impossible, because, you know, the player who's in the lead in Melee is the one that everybody immediately focuses on and tries to shut down. So I think you're definitely onto something, Will, that those people who are the Cersei archetype, who just want to win and who don't really care about deal making, and if they do make a deal, you know, they might accept a deal from somebody, but they won't really necessarily keep it. Those are the kind of people who are not too big on Melee and favor Joust a lot more.
You know, it's funny you bring up backstabbing people as one of your favorite aspects of the game, because I do love that. We can get into a little bit later about which archetype I feel like I am, but backstabbing, I feel like, is one of the, like, real highlights of Melee to me. It's so evocative of the world and what's going on. And, you know, when you've made a 12-hour road trip with a buddy to Minnesota so you can stab him in the back at the final table of a regional Melee championship, and then walk away with that title, and then have to sit in the car for 12 hours back with him afterwards. I mean, that is just the best feeling on earth.
See, I would contend that some people say that that's the worst feeling in the world, but I want to get back to...
Will's right. It's the best
feeling. No, it's the best feeling if you win. It's the...
I was the one that won. Okay. I was curious about Greg's feelings on the matter, since he's the one I stabbed.
Yeah, all I was really going to say is Will is...
So, I want to know what, on the cast, what these four people, well, five, I guess, because Greg is sharing a microphone with Will, what everybody thinks that their Melee personalities are.
Oh, I thought we'd be able to delve into that.
I would say I'm probably closest to Brienne, with a little bit of Queen of Thorns, although I'm not much of a deal maker in Melee. I mean, I'll make a deal kind of when push comes to shove, so that's kind of why I'm leaning more towards the Brienne side of things, where I'm kind of more defensive, and yeah, just kind of waiting for my moment to strike kind of player.
My archetype definitely depends on how tired I am. If I'm like really tired, I'm a Cersei and I just play to win and like ignore everybody else at the table because I don't feel like making deals. And that often happens if I'm playing like at one of my weekly game nights, you know, after a day of work or classes or whatever, and I just can't be bothered interacting with people. I'll definitely be more of a Cersei type, but I think in general I'm very Queen of Thorns. I like making deals and trying to, you know, manipulate the other people at the table and get them to do what I want them to do, and, you know, making those backstabs at the right moment and making them count is always fun.
I would say that I'm probably half Brienne, half Cersei. Probably in my earlier days of playing Thrones, I was more Brienne, all about making deals, sticking to my deals, you know, like it was really hard for me to break a deal. Like I almost felt like I'd violated a part of myself, even though it was just a game if I broke a deal. And so basically my compromise to myself was actually to become more of a Cersei player, which is just to go all out. Don't really care about the deals, don't really care about what other people are just what they're doing, and try and build like first turn win melee decks kind of.
That's an interesting take. You were so Brienne, you became Cersei. I never would have thought about that, but I actually think that's kind of a neat like parallel to the world of A Song of Ice and Fire, because, you know, like Jamie's kind of reminiscing about how he set out to become, you know, Sir Arthur Dayne and somehow became the Smiling Knight instead. So I like the thought that your honor actually turned you into this power-hungry fiend.
Although
that is pretty perfect.
I will say that the one time I really did well at Melee, which was 2011, when I made the final table at Worlds, was probably my most Queen of Thornsy deck. That was a Martell Knights of Olive Hill reinforcement deck. So I was very much trying to get the challenge phases to fall a certain way so that I could win those games. So yes, probably in best if I become Queen of Thornsy, but that's just generally not how I operate.
So yeah. I tend to be like the weirdest combination of archetypes. I am like part Queen of Thorns and part Chella, in the sense that, like, in the early game, if I can get things to fall the way I want them to go, then I will absolutely make deals and keep making deals until it's not advantageous for me anymore. But if I see the game, like, falling away from me and I, like, have no way to leverage anything else, then I'll just try to absolutely like just wreck the table like however I possibly can. I just want to make sure that like the kookiest result comes out, and like, because I love Varys. Like Varys is a great card in Joust and Melee, and he's hilarious in Melee because Lannister isn't very popular in Melee, so treachery doesn't exactly like become a thing. And like I just think it's so fun. Like one time I played a deck where I was just trying to leverage Varys in a Melee, and I popped a Varys turn one and then followed it up with March to the Wall, and it was the funniest thing in the world. And like I got such intense satisfaction out of that because I realized that my deck was not going to be fast enough to be able to compete with the other people's, so I just wanted to blow up the world. So I tend to be part Queen, part Chella Daughter of Check.
So basically, if you can't scoop immediately because you're playing Melee, you just wreck the world?
Yeah, because Luke the Scoop is a thing.
Yeah, I would have to say I personally am a Queen of Thorns, with maybe a bit of a Cersei bent. I love making deals and the social interaction and whatnot, though I tend not to play decks that are built around actually using those effects. So folks that know my Melee history know my pet deck in first edition was the Greyjoy Unopposed Holy thing, which is the deck, I would argue, is very Cersei, but I felt like I played much more Queen of Thorns. So it was kind of fun trying to dream up deals and ways to influence people when my deck didn't actually offer those types of tools.
But I definitely, in casual games, played a lot more, you know, really Doug Martell with good grief, the Baratheon daughter. Why has my brain shut down on me, guys? Someone save me.
Shireen?
Marcella.
Oh, sorry. Marcella.
That could trade titles and gotcha. Do a lot of really Queens of Thornsy thing, but I always did that more in just casual sort of games. So it was entertaining. But you guys sent me down another interesting train of thought that I'm kind of curious. When you're in the scope of, say, like an organized tournament for Melee, I'm kind of curious, you know, who out of these archetypes is most likely to succeed? Because I'm kind of thinking about what the personal goals are of these archetypes. And Luke's the one that sent me down here talking about his goal shifting to just causing chaos. And, you know, if the cello player is getting their personal satisfaction out of something kind of extraneous to the game anyway, and the Circes are really getting it from locking down a win ASAP, and the Queen of Thorns are getting it by, you know, manipulating and actually interacting socially, I'm kind of wondering, like, does the goal of like a Brienne player in, I feel like this defensive thing is kind of more, I want to not lose as a goal rather than win. So I'm a little worried that maybe they're always playing for like second place at best. Like, do you guys think any of the archetypes can rise to the top, or does some kind of hold themselves back?
So if I were in a competitive setting, I would absolutely be more of a Cersei player. But, so like that being said, I actually feel like Cersei players tend to be the most competitive and the most likely to make decisions based on their standing at the table. So I think that archetype in terms of player type tends to be the one that's the most calculated in terms of their position at the table. Therefore, they stand the best chance of making the cut, which is the best way to try to win the tournament. That's just me.
But is Cersei the most calculated, though? I mean, isn't that archetype more aggressive and, like, all-out just rush?
That's what I would say.
Yeah, I think Queen of Thorns is definitely the most calculated. And to answer your original question, well, I think definitely, like, all of the archetypes, with the possible exception of Chella, have a pretty good chance of winning. I think it's tough to win if you're just kind of trying to, like, destroy the world and, like, basically just mess up everybody else and create chaos. But I think, you know, if a Queen of Thorns player manipulates their opponents correctly, or a Brienne player is able to defend to put them until they can get themselves into a position where they can win, I think either of those two can definitely win as well.
Okay, here's my reasoning on Cersei. Like, a Cersei player is only concerned about the win condition. And so, like, in Melee, when all of the other stuff is going on, like, a Cersei player will not deviate from that. And in Melee, like, people make mistakes, people make challenges that they shouldn't make, they forget certain things that are out on the board because there's three different board states. Like, I feel like the social interaction is, like, it's a plus, but it's not absolutely key to you winning. Like, a Cersei player will take a really, really, like, finely crafted, optimized deck that has a specific goal in mind and will absolutely play to that playstyle and hopefully just, like, ride that out to the victory. I don't know that a Queen of Thorns deck, like, if they don't see, or at least a Queen of Thorns player, like, if they don't see certain things, I don't know how long they can hold out and bluff those things or try to manipulate their opponents into doing those things that they want them to do in order to win, since Melee only lasts, like, 3, maybe 4 rounds.
Well, I would think naturally the Queen of Thorns player, the longer the game goes, the more advantage they have over the Cersei players, because Cersei will try to, you know, win, because that's all she cares about, right? So if any of these archetypes are going to be more exposed than the other, I would think it's Cersei. And if the game is going long, then chances are she's been exposed.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And especially, I think another interesting thing to consider is like the breakdown at a table of how many of any particular personality are there, right? So like if you sit down at a table
and you're the one Brienne that got paired up against three Cerseis, all the defending in the world is not going to stop that. Versus, you know, you're one Cersei at a table with two Briennes and a Queen of Thorns. The game's probably not going your way. I think there's a lot of interesting interplay there in the table.
I'm curious, like, so then how do you break down, like, early, mid, and end game in a melee format then? Because in Joust, it's a little bit easier to predict, like, the power totals and the number of plots that you and your opponent have both revealed. Like, in melee then, because it lasts such a short amount of time in terms of plots revealed, obviously, like, actual minutes played, it lasts a long time. Like, I'm having a hard time seeing how this Cersei player doesn't have a natural advantage if a melee game is only 2 to 3 plots.
Well, because, I mean, a Cersei player, while they do have the advantage of having that rush potential, if they are playing very rashly, which I think their archetype is wont to do, and are just kind of going for that win as quickly as possible. If you have a good Queen of Thorns player at the table, they'll be able to see what that Cersei player is doing and convince everybody else at the table to gang up on that one player. And if you're ganged up on in a melee game, it is very hard to win because you are having, you know, potentially 9 challenges thrown at you in a round, and 3 of those are power, so you're losing power, and then that Queen of Thorns player, after they've convinced everybody to go attack you, they are now free to, you know, spread their attacks throughout the rest of the board, grab some power, and maybe sneak in a win.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Patrick. As far as dividing things up into, like, early, mid, and late game, I think in melee, that probably is one plot phase a piece, with anything 3 and beyond being late to very late. But the thing is, even though it's not very many plots, it's a high number of challenges. And like Patrick was saying there, the Queen of Thorns are going to be looking for these openings. And Cersei just hands it out by saying, you know, look at this giant target on my back. And if you've got other players willing to, you know, throw that high number of challenges at you, you know, it could be an issue.
So I guess I'm starting to realize that I may be more of a Cersei player than I originally thought.
If that's fair.
I don't know. I guess, you know, the idea of a 3-plot game, despite how many challenges are going against you, is still dictated by the cards on the table. And so if you've still got the best board state with the widest character spread and the best icon spread, then there's no reason why you don't think that you can win.
Well, thinking you can win and actually doing it are not always the same.
Exactly, which is why I was saying I'm more of a Cersei player than I originally thought. Like, I'm just saying, like, the mentality is different from what I thought that I may have been. The Chella thing still does appeal to me in casual games, but in a competitive setting, I still think that I would probably lean more towards Cersei, just because I think that, like, if you bring a really efficient deck that you've been able to miraculously test in melee because you've miraculously found at least 3 other players to play melee with you consistently, like, then I think that you have a really good shot at winning if you have that mentality.
So I'm kind of curious, Cameron, you know, from looking at the rest of the players you guys had show up for the Lord Commander, you know, would you say you were able to get a feel for some of these archetypes and like just general representation, like mostly Cersei's, mostly Brienne's, that kind of thing?
Yes, I would probably say, you know, Cersei is, you know, naturally, I think, probably the more simple kind of deck to play. You're trying to do this one thing really well. So I think people who are kind of just learning melee and stuff like that are going to naturally gravitate towards that playstyle. Try to just do that one thing and hope it works. So yeah, there was a number of Cersei players that I saw. Some Brienne players, I think myself included there, and Queen of Thorns, of course, with the deal making and whatnot. But yeah, I would say that Cersei is probably the most prominent archetype there.
You know, I kind of hate to steal a story from someone else, but I thought it was pretty awesome as a representation of Chella in Melee. So props to Sean from Cardboard of the Rings, who was there playing Melee at the event and had relayed to me a story about the first turn of his first game, where three players, I can only assume that they were Cersei players, all revealed trading with the Pentoshi. And then the fourth player, who obviously was a Chella, opened with naval superiority, which just sounded like the most glorious plot cluster ever.
Oh, that, my God. That
is that the guy, fucking dream.
That guy must have had the biggest target on his back for the rest of the game, though. Whoever flipped naval, everybody is just going after him immediately.
Yeah. And the crazy thing being with the tradings, like, everyone still had quite a bit of gold. So, yeah, I don't know, I mean, that really cool.
The naval players got, what, 11 gold? Everybody else has 6?
Yep.
That's when I drop Varys.
Totally.
I just see, want...
There's something to be said.
At some point, all four players to flip trading with Pentoshi, and everybody just has 19 gold, and it's just... Everybody just vomits their hand all over the board. And
then one person plays Varys.
Living the dream right there.
So, are we done with Melee? Is that pretty much it?
Yeah, that was some good Melee.
Yeah, I think that was some good discussion. I definitely have some other thoughts that I think I'll table for the moment for another episode. But I think that kind of breaks ground, so to speak. Gets the ball rolling for some more discussion, and I'd love to hear what the listeners think about things from here. Right, I guess then that's going to send us on to props and slops.
All right, I have a prop. I have a prop for Will's ass from Aaron.
You know, I have been told by many people, not just Aaron, that it is pretty spectacular.
There you go. And also a prop to Will for getting married here soon. That's fantastic.
Well, thank you. Thank you, sir. I'm pretty excited about it. Doesn't quite feel real yet. I'm sure it'll seem like a day's that actual weekend, but we'll get there.
Props to Game of Thrones, the show, coming back this Sunday. I have almost watched all 5 seasons in the last week and a half.
Wait, you like rewatching from the beginning?
Yep.
Dang.
Yep, rewatching the whole thing. Well, I mean, it's been like, you know, a couple of years since I've seen all of them, so decided to go back through, check them all out. I really like the show.
Watching. Yeah. So you're on season 5 now?
I am on season 5. It was a little rough, but I have faith that they're going to pick it back up for this season. I'm very excited.
Yeah. Trailers are looking pretty baller.
I'm working through season 5 right now, doing a rewatch, and there's some really great moments, of course, like any other season, but man, there's some low points too at the same time.
Definitely.
All right, I have a prop. Today is 420. That's not what I'm propping up, but many other people will.
Just please.
Yesterday was April 19th, which was the 5.5-year anniversary from our very first podcast airing. And so I am just propping Will, who has done the legwork, the arm work, the back work, the shoulder work, pretty much almost all the work to keep this podcast up and running for 5.5 years. That's a pretty phenomenal number right there. So props to Will for being the machine to keep this thing going.
Thank you, sir. And it's funny you mentioned that, because the position I've been stuck in for about 90% of this podcast is actually pretty killer on the back and shoulders. So there is that.
Yeah, for the record, I mean, having gotten to watch Will deal with all the technical difficulties in this episode lasting almost 3 hours, when you count dealing with all the just online junk of getting people to be able to talk at the same time in different locations. You know, just the amount of work just to get tonight to roll is quite a bit. So,
well, I mean, speaking of that work, I think we're remiss if the other co-hosts don't get a prop as well. For sticking through well, you know,
they have that stuck
that is a large time commitment, and they put up with the hassle, and I know have been trying to figure out things on their end and whatnot. So I think that that prop should go all the way around.
Well, thank you very much. I will accept that prop on behalf of the fellow co-hosts.
now to give your speech. I would also like to prop God, my family, my agent.
I do not get a prop as part of this co-host prop, though, because I would leave for periods of time and go read a book or play on my phone or something like that. So,
yeah, Greg was reading Elantris during most discussions.
I would like to prop the horse Gunrunner. He was born in Kentucky, and he is the current number one ranking on the circuit for the spring meets coming up. So as far as the Triple Crown is concerned, he is the front runner. And it's been a long time since Kentucky's had a horse ranked number one, as many of the purses are going out of state. So props to Gunrunner and props to his jockey that I know personally, Florent Giroux. So there you go.
Oh, that's cool. Can we talk for a moment about how awesome the name Gunrunner is for a racehorse?
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I mean, you know, horses always have the best names. It's just so sad that they don't get to own them. But he's won 4 out of his last 5 races, and he's won them by several lengths in each one. So I think he's set pretty well going up to Churchill Downs here in about 2 weeks.
Nice.
Also realize I'm the only one that gives a shit about horse racing, so...
You know, I wasn't going to say it out loud, Luke, but I was thinking to myself, you know, man, only folks from Kentucky know what Luke is talking about right now.
Definitely accurate.
Yeah, it took us 20 seconds in your intro to even know what you're talking about. Will and I had to pantomime little fingers racing so we knew what you were talking about. So,
it was pretty great. I wish there was video.
Well, props to the Derby because it's the best American holiday that ever existed.
That is bold. That is a very bold statement.
That is a statement. Man, someday we're going to do a segment where we just get to make bold statements and see what happens.
Wait, isn't that every team left episode?
Well, no, that's not a communal statement making bold
statements.
Yeah,
that's just every time Aaron opens his mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah, slops to Aaron. Get out of here, Glazer.
Hey, he's busy with his own
show. He is busy with his own show. But I still haven't gotten vengeance for the time that he said that Lauren Fitch was better than me at everything. Which, although true, didn't need to be stated on the cast. It was just, you know, it's a matter of principle, not a matter of accuracy.
Gotcha. Okay, that's got to keep up appearances.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, she is. She's the Fitch that wins, so.
Yeah, you don't hear anything about the Haynes.
Yeah, that's exactly true.
I hear things about the Haynes wear, but...
That's an entirely different thing, I hope.
Props to Cameron for coming on with us tonight and dealing with all of the bullshit technology issues.
Hey, I think I offered my fair share.
Well, yeah, thanks for joining in. It really makes you feel like a member of the team.
I'm contributing in some way.
Yeah, exactly.
But no, slops to Comcast, man, seriously.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Every cable company, pretty much Comcast, Mediacom, they all suck.
Pretty much.
But I will give props to, I'll say, Rob St. John for putting out some awesome content on YouTube. He's been doing a lot of streaming commentaries. Like, I know how much work that takes to do, and he's been really grinding away at it, making great stuff.
Yeah. Grinding is a good way to do it. I don't know. He has a time. He's always posting updates about stuff. Man, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah. They're doing it right.
For sure.
I mean, I attempted Doblik Talk before my computer broke down, and that was a lot of work just to get out my little crappy videos. So, and I'll make them again if I ever get a work.
I was going to say, Greg, I miss you just throwing cards across the room.
Nope.
Just making it rain with all the Night's Watch banner cards that didn't need to be in a deck.
You know, thinking about that, I'm waiting for the re-release that we know has to be coming of Without His Beard, because I want Greg to just tear it up on Dobbler Talk Live.
Oh, no, I can't wait for the Great Beards of Westeros episode for that.
Oh, man, that'll be good. That'll be good.
Props to Andreas for winning La Tenoir de la Main. That's fantastic. Love it.
Yeah. For a half a second, I was like, who's Andreas again? Because he's changed to go in by Buzz, essentially, everyone. So it's really throwing me for a loop.
Props to the Dance with Dragons tournament in New York that is in 10 days. If you live anywhere in the Northeast, you should be there, because I will be there. And I live in the Midwest, so if I can make it, you can make it.
Yeah.
Like, I just, slops that I can't go.
End on slops.
Yeah, slops to Luke we won't have for not going.
For 2 weeks, and like, close it off.
Slops to me for having a toddler and family that, you know, I'd rather spend time with than spend several hundred dollars on a plane ticket and stuff.
Rookie mistake.
I mean, that sounds like a personal problem. Yeah. You said you want to spend time with them. So, you know, that's the problem. Okay, that was less funny than I expected.
Yeah, you basically just said, you know what, Luke? You had kids, so fuck you.
Well, I think that's an inherent problem with having everybody mute themselves while they're not talking, is we forget to unmute, and then you can't hear us laughing at other people's jokes, right. So it sounds like we're all just really not funny.
Nope, it's staying
that's true.
Staying in.
And I would like to point out that several times this episode, I have purposefully unmuted myself just to laugh so that it wasn't dead awkward air for other people's jokes.
Slops to Will for unmuting himself just to laugh.
Behind the scenes, crazy the work that goes into this stuff.
And slops to Luke, who, if we get an explicit rating, it's completely due to him.
Yeah.
For this episode. So
yeah. Props to me for getting an explicit rating.
It used to be Daryl's job, and then Kyle. Now evidently Luke's gonna take it.
Hey,
Luke has picked up the torch.
Hey, you know what? Props to me being on an episode that's finally not a freaking chapter pack review. Oh my god.
You know, the funny thing is, the cards were all out. We could have made this week a chapter pack.
I have them. I have my cards in my hand.
Ooh, rubbing it in.
Luke was rubbing it in. Slops to Luke again. This is like the fourth one, but Luke was rubbing it in earlier this week. I was talking about building a deck that has some new cards, and Luke just straight sent me a picture of him holding three copies of the card. And I was like, what's that, man?
That's pretty great. Well, I think we should probably go ahead and draw props and slops here to a close.
Man, that's the longest props them. And slops ever.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to leave them no longer on the Cameron. I wish the listeners could see this, because Cameron just turned his camera on long enough to show off some of the cards from the new chapter pack to everyone.
Nightmares, guys.
There we go. It was even sleeved already. It is in a deck.
Man, I'm going to have nightmares about not having my chapter pack.
About Iron Mines.
I'll have to pick my next Iron Mines tomorrow. Okay. Well, as I was starting to say, we're not going to leave this on a totally negative note for props and slops. I'm gonna reprop Cameron for joining us this week for the usual shit show of an episode.
Absolutely.
Thanks for coming on.
No problem.
Chat some Melee.
Yep.
We'll try and have you on again another time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Maybe update us some more about some of the special tournament going on up in the Frozen Wasteland.
Yes.
And I'm gonna end with slops to myself for abandoning the show for 2 weeks. Yes, listeners, I mentioned it earlier, but I'm gonna bring it up again so that no one misses it. We are gonna be off the air for the next consecutive 2 weeks as I get final preparations and things out of the way. So we'll be up and running again with episode 247 post wedding. But I'm sure there'll be articles and deck lists and things to look at on the website. So keep them coming. And that closes this chapter of the White Book. We'll be right back.
You know, sorry, I mean the question, and I'll just answer it.
What's up?
Yeah, I didn't get that either.
And now they can't hear Cameron. Okay, and we just lost someone?
Is that yeah, Luke just, I think he just accidentally hit the hang up button.
Now I'm here, sorry.
Did you miss the mic mute button?
I did. Yep.
I think that's your Easter egg for the week, Will.
It was recorded. If only I could show Luke physically popping in.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Maybe I'm the curse because I'm the newest member of the White Book. Maybe
that's what it is.
I think that's probably what it is.
Luke the Scoop fucking everything up.
He's gonna make me scoop the podcast.
Oh, that's the Easter egg. That's the Easter egg. All right. Well, this didn't work 2 weeks in a row. Scoop.